Welcome to you folks. My name is Jane Vann. I teach Christian education at Union Theological Seminary and Presbyterian School of Christian Education in Richmond, Virginia. And our topic today is becoming a worship-centered congregation. We're going to be talking about the process of cultural change. As we get started today, I want to know who's in the room. We heard from John earlier that we've got people from all parts of the world, all parts of the country, all different branches of the church, all kinds of particular roles you fill in the congregation. So, who's here? We got musicians here. Some musicians, great. Have we got educators here? Good, good. Have we got lay leaders here? Couple. And pastors. We got pastors here. Welcome to all of you. How about denominations? I know a Christian Reformed Church is here, right? Yep, a bunch of those. Reformed Church in America? Yep. How about Lutherans? We have any Lutherans today? Welcome. Presbyterians. Have we got Presbyterians? Good for you. Thanks for showing up. Roman Catholic. Any Roman Catholics today? Anybody whose tradition I did not name?
UCC.
UCC? What about Methodist AME Zion? Methodist AME Zion. Who else? Call it out.
Free Methodist?
Baptist. Welcome to all of you. I'm glad you're here. How about your geographical location? I bet we got a lot of people here from the upper Midwest, right? Is that what you call Western Michigan? Or is that
Western Michigan?
Western Michigan, okay. How about the West? Many people here from the West or West Coast? Couple people. The Southwest. Anybody from the Southwest? Texas, New Mexico, Arizona? Nope. Canada. Who's here from Canada? Yay! Welcome our neighbors. And how about people from the Northeast? Good. How about the South? We got people from the South? Virginia, North Carolina, around there. And how about people from outside North America? Anybody from outside North America? Well, I hope you were looking as the people in the room raised their hands. We have a lot in common, but we have also a lot of things that make us distinctive. And so as we talk about the process of cultural change, what we will probably not talk about are the particular cultural practices that shape the place you come from. What we will talk about are the ways in which worship-centered congregational life calls for people to change what they've done, perhaps, to do things differently, to consider things they haven't considered before. So we're going to talk about that process. Cultural change means doing things differently, to change those habits and practices, to set aside long-standing ways of doing things. And it means learning new practices. Now, how easy is that? Right. I get that laugh way low in the back of your throat, like, ha! I teach a course at Union PSCE, and it has a formal title, but I call it Teaching Skills for PhDs. So I get all the people from biblical studies and church history and ethics and theology and Christian education, and I get them all in the same room at the same time, and I'm supposed to teach them what they need to know about teaching in higher education so that when we grant their degrees and they go off to teach somewhere, they got a clue. So one of the things I do for them is I try to both model and then unpack various ways of teaching and what the pros and cons of all those ways of teaching are. They get a chance to practice. One of those methods, it's called direct instruction. You don't need to know what that's all about. But it means that you're sort of a coach. And you teach somebody something new, and you let them practice, and you help them out, and then you make them go practice on their own and bring it back. Well, when I do that part of this course, I always have the students make a quilt block. I give them a particular pattern and some fabric and some thread, and I show them how to do it, and I say, okay, now, you do it. Well, they're doctoral students. They're not quilt makers, and they have a hard time. In fact, this past time when I taught this course, a fella, you know, a good old boy, a good old North Carolina boy with kind of stubby fingers, right in the middle of all this, looked at me and said, when we get finished, I'm going to go home and I'm going to make a list of all the stuff I'm really good at. Now, one of the reasons I teach these folks this particular method and do it this way is because I want them to remember what it feels like to be a novice, to be on unfamiliar territory, to not know how to do what it is you're being asked to do. Initiating cultural change in congregations is sort of like that, and people feel very unsettled. Cultural change is even more unsettling because our cultural practices rest on a bedrock of assumptions, and those assumptions rest on a bedrock of beliefs and values. So when you talk about cultural change, you're asking people to re-examine some of the things they hold most dear, they care most about, things they've committed their lives to. One of the books we use in education is titled, What Keeps Christian Adults from Learning? And my favorite chapter in the book is titled, The Need to Be Right and the Pain of Learning. Well, when you ask people to enter into cultural change, you're asking them to re-examine a whole lot of things they thought they were right about. And it's painful. It's painful. I've given you a handout, the first one. It's called Perspective Transformation at the top. This comes from a book by a guy named Jack Mesereau, an educational theorist who's not really a church person, but whose work is used in a lot of Christian education places. He starts out by saying that part of development in adulthood is overcoming limited, distorted, or arbitrary selective modes of perception and cognition. And it means we have to reflect on those in-place assumptions. Sometimes this kind of perspective transformation, or the reconsideration of our assumptions, is initiated by an encounter with difference. And in fact, if we are in the midst of liturgical renewal in our congregations, guess what? We are intentionally asking our people to encounter difference, to do something differently from the way they've ever done it before. One congregation I know, this will be familiar to you, one congregation I know started closely following the liturgical year. That's more than just putting up the right colors on the right days, but actually organizing their services both in content and in ethos, in expression, to match the season, the liturgical season. So on a particular Pentecost Sunday, when communion was being celebrated, there was celebrative music. There were banners. There was a lively procession. And not surprisingly, some folks were unhappy about that. This is a very good pastor. His name is David Batchelder. And he made a point to know who those people were who were unhappy with the way communion had been celebrated. And he went to talk to them. He recounted one conversation that went something like this. He went to visit an older gentleman who said, "Well, you know, I'm sitting in my pew and I'm trying to meditate quietly on Jesus' death and how he died on the cross and all of that. And all this lively music is going on. It really got in the way." He was very used to a kind of celebration of communion that was sort of like a funeral for Jesus. And his own individual personal way of appropriating that kind of celebration. So to do it differently, to invite people to the joyful feast of the people of God, disrupted some of his most long-standing assumptions and beliefs and values about what communion is and what it's for. So when we engage in liturgical renewal, we are intentionally asking people to encounter difference. Now, Mesereau spends a whole book talking about the cognitive dimensions of that. And then toward the end of the book, he quotes some research by Todd Sloan, which I think helps us in the church a lot. Todd Sloan talks about what it feels like. Not how the thinking process is affected, but how the emotions are affected. Here's what he says. There's this initial encounter with difference. And almost immediately, there's a kind of shock and immobilization. Now, for some folks, that can be a really celebrative, liberating kind of thing. For other folks, it's frightening, it's threatening, it's to be resisted. Which do you find most in your congregations? What do you find?
Resistance.
Resistance. Especially around matters of worship. For some reason, we tend to normativize. We think the way we've always worshiped is the way it is everywhere, the way it ought to be that we're doing it right. So that shock and immobilization stops people in their tracks. Then there's a moment of denial where you want to push that away. You don't want that encounter with difference to continue. And as we all know, a sustained encounter, if you hold your ground, if you continue to initiate and follow through with liturgical change, it can lead to anger. Or like my mother-in-law said to me one time, "You can't think that." You can't think that. It's a desire to hold it off, to push it away. The result of this denial and fear can be depression. One realizes that important relationships can be disrupted, that ways of doing things that have been comfortable and accepted will have to be changed. And there are some problems that won't be alleviated by a change, even if one proceeds ahead. Now, I think there are lots of folks who drop out of the process at this point. I think there are people who go to a different church or just don't come to worship. They only come to ladies' circle or men's breakfast. So there's the consequences of sustaining an encounter with difference and moving through it are too much.
Could I ask?
Sure, sure.
To interrupt, but we're going through some of this, and we've reached about this point, and are trying to be sensitive to this. But some of my good members have asked how it is that the people who have been resistant to this kind of change go to a whole new church where the change is going to be even greater.
Yeah.
Is there some explanation for it? Some way to account for it?
Here's a guess. This is a guess, and I hope you have other guesses as well. I have a feeling it has something to do with the nature of power. I think it has to do with people getting to that point. They realize they don't have the power in the situation to make it go back to the way it was before. And it's the powerlessness that they don't tolerate. Yeah. Yes, you. I'm sorry. I have vision problems, so if you think I'm looking at you, I'm probably not. And if you think I'm not looking at you, I probably am. So, yeah.
Just looking at Sloan's stuff here, I'm impressed that it's a lot of the stages of grief and loss.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm thinking for people who are hitting this point, maybe looking at a different point, is like, everything I like about this church is gone. So, like, what is there left? So
yeah.
Time to find something new.
Yeah, yeah, good
it's
point.
It's kind of like I've buried this, it's time to move on.
Yeah, just give it up completely. What I loved is gone now. Yeah, yeah, good point. Yes?
Psychologically, I think there's a difference between being a guest and a host.
Hmm.
You know, if we stay and we're there and we don't have any energy of this loss of power or grief from loss or whatever it is, it just takes too much, so we need to disengage. And when we're somewhere else, then we become a guest.
Yeah.
And we don't need to engage right away. So there's a bit of a respite situation for them. And it's maybe a time for healing, but then, you know, it's a power.
Yeah. These are wonderful points, and I really appreciate it. And what I treasure is how do we think about creating that that hospitality and that room for grief as we're going through change, so that people don't have to go somewhere else. I saw another hand back here. Yes?
I was just going to bring in the element of hope.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that the grieving person has lost hope in the existing church, but a change brings hope along with it.
Right, right. So again, how do you engender hope even while changes, necessary changes, are happening? Good points. Thank you. So we've mentioned this letting go, a mourning over projects and relationships that have to be left behind, and then comes a point of testing options and looking for new entry points into the situation. When Pope John Paul died, of course, the television was full of all sorts of people being interviewed and talking about his life and his influence. And one particular interview struck me very deeply, and it was precisely on this point. A young priest was there in Vatican Square being interviewed, and he wasn't just a guy on the street. He was, he somehow had a position in helping to interpret the Roman Catholic Church for the American audience. He was an American priest. And so as the interviewer was talking to him, he said, "Well, you know, I wasn't raised a Catholic. I didn't grow up Catholic." And he went on to recount how the ministry of Pope John Paul had called him in a certain way that was irresistible. And so now, here he was, standing in Vatican Square, a young man, standing in Vatican Square, talking to the folks on CNN and helping to interpret the Catholic Church to an American audience. This man had found entry points. He tested the options. He searched for substitutes, for common ground with the life he'd led before, and initiated new relationships that led him into a kind of fulfillment as a priest that seemed to surprise even him. He described the next couple of phases, searching for meaning, being hungry for data and information about the new situation, search for new habits and symbols, the construction of an explanation of how Pope John's life had called him so that he entered the priesthood. He also talked somewhat about leaving things behind, and how he felt guilty about that sometimes, but he knew God had called him. He knew he'd made the right decision. Then folks eventually come to a point of integration where they begin to plan for the future. They imaginatively project themselves into the future and begin to figure out what this new life is going to look like. They engage in new lifestyle practices, new roles and relationships. They adopt a new culture, right? At the end of all this, many people have noted that there are feelings of rebirth, of a whole new life, a new way of being in the world. I think this is important as we try to engage people in cultural change for two reasons. One is we have a pastoral role in initiating liturgical change. It's not about a programmatic change in the way we worship. It's not about worship style. It's about presenting everyone wholeheartedly before God, proclaiming our joy and praise. And so we have a pastoral responsibility to everyone who's there to help them continue to join with the people of God in raising that joyful praise. The second thing is, I think it helps diagnostically. I think sensitive pastors can ponder these phases, and of course, they're not going to go in a straight sequential order. They're really going to go in loops and swirls and spirals when new events will throw people back into an earlier stage and they need to move forward again. It helps diagnostically so that pastors and other church leaders are able to engage with people where they are. You're noting that this parallels the stages of grief is really helpful, and it's that same sensitivity that we need to bring. So, I'd like for you to turn to your neighbor. And here's a question for you to ponder with your neighbor. Groups of twos and threes. What relevance might this view of the affective dimension of cultural change, what relevance might this have to a situation that you know about? Does this matter? And if so, how? Thank you so much for your conversation. I always feel like when church leaders are together, they probably have more to learn from each other than they do from me. So I appreciate very much the energy in the room around your conversation. What I'd like to do is move along, and then hopefully we'll have some time at the end to catch up your conversations and questions and reflections. I think cultural change in congregations takes a long time. It's not a programmatic quick fix. You can go in, you can try new music, you can try new furniture arrangements. One church in Richmond that I know was one of those little tiny southern shoebox kind of churches with maybe 10 rows of pews. And they were really stuck in this narrow space. They unbolted them all and turned them around sideways. You can do things like that real quick. You can do things like that real quick. I think what we're talking about is a much deeper kind of cultural change where the orientation of worship is theocentric. It's focused on God, as we heard earlier this morning from one of our panel members. And I also think it takes about 10 years. If you really expect people to be formed, to be spiritually formed by encountering God in worship and in deepening and understanding that encounter by all the other kinds of reflective conversations that go on in congregational life, it takes about 10 years. So, what do we need in order to initiate that process and sustain it over the long haul? I'm using the... I didn't hear that. Say it again.
Longer pastorates.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. In an earlier session this morning, I talked about the necessity of relationships that endure over time through thick and thin, and people learn how to work things out. With short pastorates, it's really hard to do that. Part of that long relationships helps to build what Ronald Heifetz calls a holding environment. Now, the term holding environment comes from developmental psychology, and it begins with the way we hold an infant, right? The way we hold an infant. We carry them completely, but as they grow, our way of holding them changes. You wouldn't try to hold an 18-month-old the way you hold a newborn. You wouldn't try to hold a 4-year-old the way you hold an 18-month-old. So building a holding environment includes reassurance. It includes a lot of caring for the other, providing for the needs. But it also includes appropriate challenge and encouragement that helps people move toward independence. We applaud their new accomplishments and achievements. All of these elements of a holding environment come about through relationships of trust, and they don't get built overnight. A pastor in my presbytery, Carson Rhine, talks about going to his first pastorate, again, in the South. He said he spent the first year drinking innumerable glasses of sweet tea. He visited everybody multiple times and just sat and drank sweet tea and listened and learned who they were. But after a time, that holding environment, that reservoir of trust that's built in lasting, resilient relationships began to take hold. And not only could he accompany those people in some of the most difficult moments of their lives, he could also initiate changes. He could initiate encounter with difference in that congregation that he would never have been able to do if it had not been for the building of trust and the establishment of a holding environment that has enough wiggle room in it and enough resilience to allow for the sometimes conflictual engagement with cultural change. One of the other resources that pastors bring to the initiation of cultural change is the power to shape issues, to frame issues, to talk about the way we see an issue. Now, I've already said you can look at cultural change in congregations programmatically. You can look at it pragmatically and logistically, and you can spend all day figuring out whether you've got the right sound equipment. But church leaders, pastors, educators, musicians, worship committee people, your role is to frame things theologically. Frame things theologically. So that in the midst of the reexamination of assumptions and beliefs and values, there's deep theological reflection that begins to reorient some of those beliefs and values that underlie the cultural change. So the presenting issue might be music or movement or gesture or any one of color, any one of a number of things, but it's grounded in assumptions and values, and framing those theologically is the responsibility of church leaders. If you look at the other handout I've given you, down at the bottom of the page, Ronald Heifetz lists several different strategic principles for leadership. And I want to use those points to sort of explore a case study. A pastor I know who initiated some cultural change, and use that as a way to enter into conversation with you about these strategic principles of leadership. This pastor, his name is Paul Galbraith. I'm happy to say he's now my preaching and worship colleague at Union Seminary. But when I first met him, he was pastor of a church in Tacoma, Washington. Now, this church had been the tall steeple church in Tacoma. It was the place. And all the movers and shakers in Tacoma went to church there in the heyday, in the 50s and 60s and 70s. They had a pastor who was there for 30 years, and he dropped dead. And there was not a single piece of paper in any file cabinet anywhere. So he had this whole church in his head, and it was gone. So by the time Paul Galbraith got to this church, it was down to a remnant, just a remnant. He was told by the presbytery that if he went there, if nothing happened in that church, they would close their doors in 6 or 7 years. He said when he got there, he found out that the timeline was really a lot shorter than that. And he really didn't think they had that long. One of the things this church had never done was admit children to worship. So all the children went off to church school for generation after generation after generation. All the children went off to church school and were never in worship at all. So Paul and the other leaders of the church decided that that was unfaithful, that we were called to welcome everyone into the worship of God, and maybe even especially our own children. So they tried for a year or more all sorts of things to include children in worship for longer periods of time. It started out they were there for announcements and a couple of other things, and then they left. And then they'd lengthen the time, but nothing really worked. The church, the culture of the church was such that nothing was really happening. So the leaders of the church decided that in order to exhibit faithful leadership in this congregation, they really had to take a bold step. They had to challenge the cultural norms. They had to bring people face to face with different cultural practices. And what they decided to do was include children in the entire worship service during Advent. Doesn't sound like a very bold experiment to me. He said, if you'll pardon me, I'm quoting him, all hell broke loose. He said he'd never seen so much reaction. And he said that, so, to connect this to the handout you've got, they had identified an adaptive challenge. The leaders of this church had identified an adaptive challenge. If they were going to live faithfully to the call of the gospel, they had to include children in worship. They identified it, and they initiated a step that would make that come true. He said, Paul said, that there were three factions in the opposition. One was parents of young children who said, 1 hour. All I want is 1 hour. There were also the longtime members of the church who said, children are disruptive. It's too noisy. We don't want them in here. They've never been in here. Why do we need them in here? And then there were the parents of the teenagers who said, you know what my kids say? They say, boring. And they don't want to come, and you'll drive my child out of the church, and he'll never come back, and you can't do this. So, the leaders of this congregation decided that they needed to stick to it. They needed to keep the pressure on, but they also needed to keep the level of distress at a manageable level. A couple ways they did that was to say, this is an experiment. It's 4 weeks long. We're just going to see what this is like, and we're going to work out what the implications are. We're going to use this as an experiment so we can see the way forward. The other thing they did was practice what my colleague Bill Arnold calls the less anxious presence. Now, Bill is a pastoral care guy, and a lot of pastoral care people talk about a non-anxious presence. Bill says that's a little bit too much to ask of folks. So how about a less anxious presence? So the situation is not about me as a leader and my anxiety. It's about us figuring out a way forward. In the midst of all that, they strove to balance the necessary challenge and support that exist in the holding environment. If there's too much challenge, you get absolute resistance and there's no way forward. If there's too much support, you get a confirmation of the status quo and there's no way forward. So very delicately balancing that challenge and that support kept them moving forward. They focused attention on what Heifetz calls ripening the issues. Not letting it just sort of settle in, but keeping the conversation going so that people were able to mentally appropriate the question before them, to imagine what it might be like to engage in this change. They did that by, first of all, having several y'all come, you know, everybody show up, let's sort of have a town meeting and discuss the issues involved. There were also small group meetings with each of the factions that were involved, including voices in each of those meetings of people who viewed it differently, who thought having children in worship was a very important thing to do, part of what they were called to do. So those conversations help people to hear all points of view. And these were the places, among others, where they framed things theologically, where they talked about the spiritual formation of children, how children appropriate worship in a multi-sensory way and help the whole congregation see what was at stake. Then they gave the work back to the people and engaged in conversations where they brainstormed. You know, during Advent, if children are going to be there, what are we going to do? And how are we going to welcome them? How are we going to manage whatever problems might arise from their presence? One of the things they did surprised me, but it was something that these brainstorming sessions led to. It was they made a children's corner in the sanctuary. So they put a big quilt on the floor, and they had books and a few toys, maybe some crayons and paper, I don't know. But children were free to come and go as the service progressed, so that they had a way of being in the room, but also learning to manage their own childishness, their own fidgetiness, and learning a new skill of sitting in the pew. Paul said they were able to remove that very soon because it turned out they didn't need it as much as they thought they would. Children were much more interested in worship than people had anticipated. But the point is, the people of the congregation entered into brainstorming and problem solving and figuring it out so that it became their project. The other thing Paul did was protect the voices of others who did not have the same kind of pastoral authority he did. I've watched him facilitate conversations many times, and he has a wonderful way of saying to folks, "That's a really important point you made. What do others think?" Keeping everybody in the conversation, protecting people who don't have the kind of institutional authority that comes with being a pastor. Well, children participate in worship at Emmanuel in Tacoma all the time now. About a year after these events that I've tried to describe, they were inviting a new class of members to join. So around the dinner tables, they were asking people, as Tom Long said this morning, asking people why they were interested in this church and why they came. And several of the families with young children said, "We can tell that you love children, that you have a place for children in worship. The way you include children is wonderful, and we think that's just terrific. We want that for our children." Now, those newcomers reflected back to them an image of themselves that they were not aware of. They remembered the difficulty and the conflict and the contentious conversations. But eventually, the cultural change got traction. It became the cultural norm that children were in worship. And newcomers weren't aware that it had ever been any different. Well, that's a success story. I could probably give you a bunch of others that aren't quite that successful, but it's by way of illustration of a way of thinking about cultural change that that I think may give us some insight into liturgical change in our congregation.